Hello, my darlings, and welcome to this week's episode of A Little Bit Human podcast. I want to start by saying it is March, and therefore it's Women's History Month. So happy Women's History Month. And speaking of Women's History Month, I have a very interesting story for you. So the story takes place in a very weird period of history, I'd like to say. It's a period of history when the Vikings were flourishing in England. Electricity had not been invented yet, and personal hygiene was definitely not an important part of people's lives. Like, trust me, I know a lot of people have like romantic notions about Vikings, but if you think morning breath is bad now, just wait till you kiss a Viking with morning breath who has not brushed in years. Disgusting. Anyways, so this is the 9th century. Welcome to the 9th century. Our protagonist is a young girl named Agnes, who wanted nothing more than to go to school. But she was a girl, so she couldn't go to school. So Agnes had a cunning plan. What she did was she cut off her hair, she wore boys' clothes, and she changed her name to John. And that's how she got her education. Now, okay, I have to be honest with you. I had very, very short hair when I was a kid, when I was like 6 or 7. I'm pretty sure 3 or 4 boys in my class had the same haircut, but I could not have passed for a boy for longer than a day at most. So the fact that Agnes did it for years, super impressive. She learned a bunch of subjects. She was super, super smart. But then our rebellious little scholar did something even more rebellious. Can you guess? She fell in love with a monk. I know, a monk. Now, I'll be the first person to say I don't know anything about monks. I know a lot about nuns, primarily because I've watched The Sound of Music like 77 times. But monks, the only thing I know about them is that they're supposed to be celibate, which means that they don't have sex, which makes this story even more scandalous. Anyways, so her and her monk lover monk, whatever, the monk she fell in love with, they traveled to Athens together and then they traveled to Rome, where everyone was so impressed by Agnes's scholarly knowledge that they gave her a job as a scribe in the Vatican. Yes, dear listeners, the Catholic Vatican itself. So there she was, just a girl in the Vatican doing Vatican things, and she made her way up to the rank of cardinal. Now skip forward a few years to 855 CE when Pope Leo IV, who was the Pope at the time, died. I also have a side note here. It is a personal peeve of mine for people to like, if you're born with the same name as the Pope before you, fine. But if you take the same name and add a number, why are you doing that? I mean, I'm English and the British royal family does this as well. Do you know how many Edwards and Georges and Henrys they have? I mean, it's just name the next one something different like Esteban and move on, honestly. Anyways, so Leo IV died. And who was elected but our girl Agnes? And she was going by John at the time. So she became Pope John VIII. Now, this is not the weirdest part of the story. I know, right? You look at me and you're like, seriously, this is not the weirdest part of the story. This woman managed to fool hundreds of people and became the Pope. It's not. The weirdest part of the story comes in 2.5 years into her rule. Do popes rule? Do they reign? Do they have you know what? Doesn't matter. Anyways, two and a bit years after Madame Pope was elected, she was participating in a procession. Now, this means that she was walking down a street, right? Or she was being carried down a street by a carriage. And in the middle of the procession, she just happened to give birth and the child slipped out of her. You know, it literally fell out of her onto the road. And that is how Pope John was outed as Pope John. I'm going to give you a couple of seconds to absorb that. Because what? What kind of story is that? I have so many questions. I mean, first, my first question is, who was the father? Was it the monk that she fell in love with originally? Because if so, that's a loyal guy. If not, how many people knew that she was a woman dressing as a man? And my second question is, how did the child just fall out? Like, I have never given birth, but I have heard enough people talk about giving childbirth that I know that it is not a fast process. It is a painful, slow process, and women have to push and push and push. Babies do not slip out of women. That's not how it works. So, oh my God, the fact that this baby just slipped out of Pope John onto the road, wild. absolutely wild, this story. And also, most likely untrue. I'm sorry. I am so sorry. I know. I took you on an emotional roller coaster. I got you invested in this story, only to crush your hopes and dreams and tell you that Pope Joan is most likely a myth. I mean, historians now have gone over her story with like a bloody magnifying glass, and they have pretty much come to the conclusion that she was just a story that people made up. But for years and years and years, I mean, literal centuries, people believed in her. Atheists, if atheists existed back then, Protestants, Catholics, they all believed in the story of Pope Joan. Why did they believe it? I could not tell you. Why did you believe it? If you did believe it. If you didn't, I'm very sorry. But I think it's just, there's something about this story, you know? It's crazy, but it's also inspiring and it's blasphemous. It's just the right mix of the three. And anyways, Pope Joan may not be a real person, but that doesn't mean that there are not women in history who have not dressed as men. There are countless examples of women who dressed as men in order to lead something, in order to be seen, in order to have their story be heard. Just off the top of my head, I can think of, there's Joan of Arc, who was a French heroine and saint, and then there is the Rani of Jhansi, who was an Indian warrior queen, both extremely strong women, both who dressed as men. And I think, so I'm a self-proclaimed history geek, you know, and there is one phrase that I have heard countless times, and you may have heard it. You may have been sitting in your high school history class and your history teacher may have been like, okay, children, now just remember, history is written by the victors. If my high school history teacher is watching this or listening to this, I am very, very sorry. I love you so much. You are literally the reason that I'm interested in history now. But if you haven't heard of this phrase, essentially it means, it serves as a reminder that history is often written by the winning party, and so it shouldn't be taken at face value. It's one of those inherent biases that history has. Side note, I love the word biases. It's such a cool word. Anyways, and then I think the story of Pope Joan brings up another really interesting bias, is that history, in a large part, is written by men, right? So for women to fight, women had to fight for their place in the narrative. They were just shoehorned in, like Pope Joan, as a sort of cautionary tale as to what happens when women, you know, try and lead or try and do something that they're not supposed to. And I think given that we are at the tail end of March and therefore the tail end of Women's History Month, I just think this is something to think about. Now, Women's History Month, that is another really, really interesting topic. Now, I recently found out the history behind Women's History Month, and yeah, there is actually a full history behind it. I mean, there's a history behind everything, let's be honest. There's even a history behind the subject of history, which I will not talk about here, but you know what? Get a few gin and tonics in me and we'll think about it. Essentially, Women's History Month, I think, can be traced back to the first International Women's History Day, which took place on March 8th, 1911. Fast forward, 67 years, my maths is not good, but 67 years later to 1978, a school district in Sonoma, California, held a Women's History Week for their kids. And it was a really fun sort of educational week where they did essay writing competitions and art competitions to promote awareness about women in history. And it must have caught on because in 1979, Sarah Lawrence College, which used to be a female college, I believe, they held a 15-day conference in July, which had guest speakers and, panels and debates talking about women's history. It was a women's history fortnight. But this idea sort of gained a lot of popularity. And that was when in 1980, President Jimmy Carter, who, by the way, I realized I don't know much about, like, I didn't grow up learning about American presidents, but I know next to nothing about Jimmy Carter. Literally, the only thing I know about him is that the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan at the end of his term. Oh, and he was involved in the Camp David Accords. But now I know one more thing about Jimmy Carter, which is potentially probably the most important thing that I have learned about Jimmy Carter, which is that he was the first president to instigate a national women's week, Women's History Week, for the whole country. So this was a presidential proclamation, very official. And after him, in 1981, there was a congressional resolution. And then for the next few years, it was National Women's History Week was a bona fide thing, right? And then after that, the National Women's History Project was sort of like, okay, Congress, thank you. You gave us a week, thanks, that's great. And they sort of spent the next 6 years petitioning for Women's History Month. And then finally, in 1987, Congress passed a resolution which designated March as Women's History Month. And since then, every March, we celebrate the women of today and the women of the past. And I think that's lovely. I think it's a really, really sort of fantastic way to honor the people who came before us. And I think it's really, really important to remember some of these women in history. Now, I was looking for interesting articles on Women's History Month, and I was scrolling through our blog, which, by the way, if you haven't checked out, you should go and check it out. It's called alittlebithuman.com, so like the name of the podcast. And it has such a wide and amazing variety of articles. So like there literally is an article about KFC coming out with a gaming console that also lets you warm your chicken. But it also has an article about sexism in healthcare and how to advocate for yourself as a woman. Both incredible articles. But I was scrolling through the blog and I saw an article called How Witchcraft Serves to Empower Women. Now, I don't know about you, but I immediately perked up like a dog that's seen a squirrel. And I was like, witchcraft? Witchcraft? How interesting. But I won't talk to you about that because we actually have the writer of the article, Rachel Green, here with us today. Rachel is a regular contributor to the blog, and she's written some really, really fantastic articles. So we're very lucky to have her. Hi, Rachel.
Hi there.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing good. How are you doing?
Good, good. On this lovely day, we are talking about witchcraft. So I'm actually having a great time.
Same. I loved researching this. I spent way more time than I needed to, but I just couldn't like stop reading about it. It's fascinating.
How did you start? Where did you even think of the idea?
Oof. So I like joined this witchcraft group on Reddit like a while ago, just because I also write short stories, and I was like, maybe I'll find some cool story ideas there. Mm-hmm. And then they turned out to be like the most like wholesome and reaffirming. Like they were just constantly like doing like casting spells for each other to give like good luck in a job interview, or like helping, like, I don't know, like, I hope your coworker, you get that promotion. Like, I don't know. They were just like always helping each other, and it was really cool. So I wanted to try to research that, like dig more into how that's like what witchcraft does for people, because or for women, because it's seen as just this like evil, like cursing.
Yeah, I often find that with witchcraft, modern day witchcraft at least, I feel like it's written off as one of two things. It's either written off as a joke, you know, it's played off as a joke, you have it used as comedic material in TV shows and stuff, or it's written off as, you know, evil and blasphemous and let's not talk about it. But where do you think that comes from? Because I feel like witchcraft, at least from where it started, seems like it started like a force for good.
So it seems like the history of the word witch itself has always had like a negative connotation, although it's like very old. It's at least 1,000 years old. And so we don't know exactly what it meant when it first appears, but it probably meant something like a pagan or a heathen, like someone who wasn't Christian and doing some weird, crazy ritual in the woods that they didn't understand. So
of course,
it's probably more just a religion or a set of religions that Christianity was trying to get rid of at the time. But the people themselves were definitely not this idea that they were evil or trying to hurt their neighbors. That was most likely never true at any point.
And was it only women, or were there like male witches as well?
So there are different statistics depending on which part of Europe you go to. I think Russia had a little more closer to 50-50 balance, but overall across Europe, it was about 80% women who were targeted for this. So there was definitely a huge gender imbalance.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, to be honest, like I said, I don't know much about witchcraft. The only sort of, I suppose, reference to it that I really come across are the Salem witch trials. But of course, in those, you really only see the female witches being persecuted, right? I mean, obviously, I'm not an expert. I can't think of a single case where I heard of a male witch being persecuted.
Yeah. So even when men would get accused, it was usually for like more victimless crimes of witchcraft, like they were trying to find lost treasure or something. And so that didn't carry the same punishment. It wasn't a death sentence for that. And then the kind of witchcraft that women would get accused of was the stuff that would be punished by execution. So that's why they were more likely to get killed.
That's fair. Sad. But what about the type of women? Was there any sort of like correlation between the women who were involved? I mean, obviously, I guess they weren't Christian women, right?
Yeah.
But the women who were involved in witchcraft.
Pretty much anyone could have been targeted, but the most common targets, which again differs in different parts of Europe, but overall it's generally old women or like unruly women. Like it could be something as light as you were just like out in the street saying profanity and they're like, oh, that's a witch, we got to burn her.
Wow, I would have been burnt so quickly back then.
It would not have like made it to adulthood.
Oh no.
Yeah. Another interesting thing I learned is that another target were midwives.
Because like women who helped with childbirth?
Exactly. But at this time they were also more like full-scale OBGYNs. Like they would perform abortions and they would provide birth control. Uh-huh. And generally just help women, like they would give them sex education, teach them how to not get pregnant and how to get pregnant when they want to.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of knowledge was like evil knowledge. So they weren't supposed to have that.
I mean, I guess that's one thing that potentially hasn't changed today.
Exactly. Basically the same women who are targeted today. Like if you're outspoken, if you're pro-choice, then you should be hung.
Mm-hmm. And like this is what, the 17th, 18th century?
So this starts, the idea of a witch in like church law is at least like the 1300s, I think 1200s or 1300s.
Okay.
That we first start seeing it. But back then it's not a felony yet. So you can't get executed for it. This punishment is a lot softer. But it's already, women are getting accused of all the bad witchcraft and men are getting accused of just like, he tried to steal treasure. It's really all they did. Oh, and men were more likely to try to talk to ghosts, apparently. Those were the only two crimes that they did.
So women, okay, I'm trying to wrap my head around this. So the only crimes that men committed were stealing treasure and talking to ghosts.
Yes. And then women were apparently the ones who would like curse your harvest to rot in the field or like give your child cholera, stuff like they were the ones who were doing like the evil curses, or at least that's what the court records reflect.
Okay. And what about like good witchcraft? What like form did that take back then?
So that was mostly like healing magic. So again, it'd be midwives before they were being persecuted. So eventually it just got to the point where, so like by the 15th century, when we start to see the witch hunts and women are dying, that's when all witchcraft is evil. Like they've decided that in order to be able to do witchcraft, you have to commune with the devil or have sex with the devil, and then you gain the power.
Wow.
So all witchcraft is evil because it's all coming from Satan.
From Satan.
Which means that even the midwives who were just trying to help you give birth, if they used any kind of strange herbs that men didn't know about, then that would be witchcraft.
Oh my God, I'm sorry. I'm just picturing like a woman sort of making, I don't know, she's just making dinner and she uses like rosemary, and her husband's like, what is this? Is this witchcraft? And she's like, no, it's just rosemary.
Oh, God. This is too good. This cannot be.
This tastes too good.
Yeah.
Wow. So then how has it sort of changed? What is modern day witchcraft like? I know you said you found it on Reddit, which I find is so cool. Like, witchcraft back then was all about, you know, the town square and the women in the town. And today it's all about Reddit. So what is modern day witchcraft like?
So, yeah, I ended up doing a survey of this group that I've been privately stalking for a year. And I was like, hey guys, I'm here. And I learned a lot of interesting things. It's about, like, the same people who are drawn to witchcraft are the same people who probably would have been accused of witchcraft anyway back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the people who are generally don't quite fit into the, like, limited role of women. It's people who are dissatisfied with their Christian upbringing because it was a little too patriarchal and rigid for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's people who just wanted to, like, feel in control of their life and kind of feel like they have some ability to define the direction of where their lives go.
That's fair. I like that. It's so, I suppose, positive, right? Which is so unlike what people associate with witchcraft. Is witchcraft is, it's considered, I mean, also if you think about how the way witchcraft is portrayed in media, it's all about, and usually women who take, who like have this unnatural power and use it for like ill-gotten gains. Whereas I think what you're describing is just people using good energy and good vibes in order to live a better life and to be free of some of the negative things that I think they exist. I also like that you said that a lot of people come from a Christian upbringing, because I think that's such an interesting, this whole idea of Christianity and the way it sort of perceives women throughout history. I mean, even Pope Joan, like I was talking about earlier, her story was perpetuated as fact by both Protestants and Catholics. Catholics used it as a way to tell people that, oh, clearly a woman's place is not supposed to be in the, women shouldn't be in the church, women shouldn't be in leadership positions. And the Protestants used it as a way to say, if a woman can fool the Catholic Church into becoming Pope, then it's fallen so far. And I think in both cases, the women suffer in the narrative.
Yeah. In both cases, it's like, better not let women rule.
They might have a child. A child might slip out of them onto the road. Oh, God. Yeah, I'm pretty sure Pope Joan would have, somebody would have thrown around the accusation of witchcraft back then.
Yeah, definitely.
Because from all I can see, obviously, I have now said that this story is most likely a myth, but the myth has a couple of different endings. And one of the endings is that she was stoned to death in the street right then and there. The other ending is that she was dragged behind a horse. The third ending is that she was hanged. Hung? She was not hung. She was hanged. she was sentenced to death. And the least gruesome ending is that she was exiled to a nunnery. And in all of them, it's like, it's this idea of, I think, the way Christianity and I guess the Catholic Church and this looks at sex and I suppose sexually free women. And I think that's probably a lot of what's associated with witchcraft today as well.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. That was a side note of what I learned is that women were also more likely to be persecuted for sex crimes, like having sex out of wedlock, which I don't know how you could persecute more women than men in that, because it's who were they having?
That's actually really funny. I didn't even think about that. Oh my God. That's amazing. That is really, really impressive. I mean, I'm just now thinking about, so I was in a high school production of The Crucible by Arthur Miller. And if you guys don't know the story of The Crucible, it essentially is in a small town. And I played Abigail, who is a young girl who flirts a lot and screams a lot. And by the end of the, which to be fair, is not that different from what I do in real life. But by the end of the play, she is accused of witchcraft purely because she is someone who flirts a lot and screams a lot. And that was actually my first introduction to witchcraft, which was very strange. So are you still in touch with the people in the Reddit group who you privately stalk?
I just still stalk them. I keep stalking them.
How are they doing?
They're doing good. It was Ostara last week, the like spring equinox. Okay. So they were all posting pictures of like their little cakes and baked goods that they were making for Ostara, which is apparently the tradition is to make like a cake that has these different herbs in it. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
That's nice. So to anyone listening, if you are a practicing witch, happy belated Ostara, you said?
I think that's how it's pronounced.
Well,
I hope so.
I'm very sorry if we mispronounced it. But that's really, really cool. Thank you so much, Rachel, for talking about this. This has been super, super interesting. Before you leave, I just want to, what is something that makes you a little bit human today? I sprung that one on you. I can go first if you want.
Yes, go for it.
So something that makes me a little bit human today is whenever I go to get blood drawn, if I ever do go to get blood drawn, I always get the weirdest compliment from the nurse or the doctor who's doing it. They always tell me that I have really nice looking veins. And it's like, part of me is sort of like, I'll take it. I'll take any compliment I can get, but also stop commenting on my veins and just, you know, put the needle in. Oh my God. Super weird. But that's what makes me a little bit human today, that my veins are nice enough to be commented on by doctors.
Congratulations on your veins.
Thank you. I would probably be persecuted for witchcraft because of my veins.
That's definitely some kind of blood magic that you're doing, for sure.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. So what about you?
Wow.
I can suggest one for you.
Sure.
Something that makes you a little bit human is that you quietly and privately stalked a witchcraft subreddit.
Yes. Yeah.
I love it. I love it. Thank you so much, Rachel. Thank you. To everyone who's been listening, I hope you enjoyed it. And we'll see you guys next time.